Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington. My co-host and host this evening is Kim Lakin, our NASCA sister ambassador from Colorado. So, hi, Kim. Glad you're on with me this evening, and I see we have a panel that's growing. That's great. Today is Monday. It is October 18th, 2021. This is scan number 2771. It's special guest night, and Kim will be taking over the show in a moment because I'm the special guest this evening, so she's graciously agreed to do the interview. So I really appreciate Kim coming on and doing that at the last minute. But before we begin and continue on the show, I wanted to invite anybody who's up there listening, if you want to become involved with NASCA, a great way to do that is just join our panel on these shows. And all you have to do is call in the following number, area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. And we'll welcome you on the back line. And you're welcome to ask our special guest, which is me, on special guest night, a question or comment regarding their story. We try and break the show up into three segments because special guest night, someone tells their story. We do that chronologically, so we typically break the show into three segments, and we break twice in between the three segments, so panel members have an opportunity to interact and ask questions a couple times. But it's a great way to get involved with NASCA and just become more familiar with the shows in general. So as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma, prevention, intervention, recovery. And Kim, would you mind reading the NASCA mission statement?
Yeah, thank you, Penelope. So we have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violence or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem, affects everyone. And number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, including providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention.
Thank you, Kim.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. And I don't know if I should say I look forward to this, but I do like to come on the show once a year as a special guest and tell my story because, number one, I love just to celebrate the fact that I'm in recovery. To me, it's just a celebration and observance of that. And then I like to listen to the shows because I go back over the years and it just, you know, helps remind me that even though some days feel like baby steps or no steps, when you look back over 365 days, you realize that even some of the baby steps, you know, they add up. They add up, and you continue moving forward in a different way. So I like to do that. So I'm very appreciative to be on as the guest this evening, and I appreciate my support. We have Shamika, our ambassador from Oregon, and John Anderson, our ambassador from Louisiana. Thanks, you guys, for calling in and supporting me tonight. And so, Kim, I'm just going to turn it over to you as we just kick off the first segment.
Yeah, so thanks again, Penelope, and welcome to all of our panelists here. So you kind of answered my first question, why you come on the show, why you like to come on the show every year. So can you give a brief summary of your childhood years?
Sure. So it's always like, where do you begin and tell your story, and especially if you've already told it, you know, two times before. But I do think it's important to, you know where you've been to put into context where you're going. So my healing journey really started 5 years ago when I was 46, and I hate to talk about age, but, you know, I think it's important, the chronology is important to my story because I talk about certain things that happened and I give dates, and so that's, I think there's some, it's relevant. But
it's just a number.
Yeah, exactly. So if you had asked me, you know, 5 years ago, so in 2016, you know, tell me a little bit about your family, you know, that you grew up in, you know, your family of origin, and what was your life like, I would have said, oh, you know, we were this perfect family, you know, we were just, you know, perfect, and everything was happy, and you know, the total Leave It to Beaver family, although both parents worked outside the home. And, you know, my life was fine. I mean, I was a working mom. I had three kids and, you know, worked hard at my career. And I was felt relatively successful at that and, you know, was involved in the community and involved in church. And, you know, life's a little busy, but everything's just great in terms of life. Well, I look back now and after, you know, going through the healing journey, I can tell you that it wasn't my life from the very beginning, from the inception, from the minute I was born, was anything but normal. I was born into a multi-generational familial cycle for my family of origin of abuse. And you can look at my family tree and it traces back over many, many, many generations. But in 2016, what changed was my primary care doctor, who had known me, I'd been in his care for 10 years, he also knew me professionally because I was a pharmaceutical rep for 11 years and I called on him for about five of them. So, and he also knew me, we were personal, close family friends, and so he knew me in that context as well. I was in a situation at work where I was being bullied by a tyrannical boss, and he noticed something in me. He said, you know, you cower when you're bullied. I think you need to look into that. And obviously he saw something that was below the surface. And so I trusted him. I'd been under his care for 10 years. And he gave me a referral to a psychologist. He's a PhD in psychology, Dr. Tim Weber. And he said, you know, I think that you need to contact Dr. Weber, and I think you just need to go and have a conversation with him about the situation. So I'd never been to therapy before in my life. So I thought, well, what do you do? Maybe I should just write down some events that happened in my life, like a chronology, just to have something. I was used to being going on sales calls and being prepared with my sales, you know, my call plans, my call for the, you know, having a plan. So I thought, well, I'll just make a list. So I made a list of all these events that I can remember in my life that may be relevant. There were about, I don't know, 20 things on the list. So I walked into this first appointment, and I just started rattling off all these things on the list. Like, I was reading a grocery list. I mean, it was very flat. And I think, wow, he must have been almost falling off of his chair, because every single thing that I had on that list was a severe trauma. It was abuse. It was severe abuse. But I didn't even see it that way. So I think, yeah, I just always mention at the beginning of my story because sometimes what you grow up in, especially as a child in an abusive home, is what you know. And I had been growing up and living in those patterns for so long, I was 46 years old, that I thought I was in this normal. I was still being abused in many different forms by my parents, by my family of origin. So I, you know, like anything else in my life, when I went to that first appointment with Dr. Weber, I was committed. You know, he gave me an assignment, start writing in a journal, write down, you know, anything that you remember. If you really want to tap into things, write with your non-dominant hand, write with your left hand, but I want to start writing. So I was always, you know, did what I was told, which not wasn't necessarily a good thing, but that was how I survived in my childhood, was just trying to be perfect and trying to do what I was told, and hopefully that any tempers within the home. So I proceeded to do what I was told to do in therapy. And I'll just now very briefly describe what I started writing down in my journaling. The first thing I wrote down was why she took me. So I was the firstborn. I was born in Menlo Park, California, originally from the Bay Area. I was born the first. I have a younger brother who's about a year younger than I am, and a sister who's about 4 years younger than I am. My parents were considered maybe to be older parents then. They were in their early 30s when I was born. And my mother, I don't know what the deal was. Other than she was very, I would say, dysregulated, but apparently anything would set her off. And she would just start screaming these visceral, piercing screams. I don't know what scream therapy is, but I can only imagine this is what it is that she would use every bone and every muscle in her body. And it would be like, I mean, I was a baby when it started. And for my earliest memory, I just couldn't remember the screaming. And it was like a landmine. I just never knew it was going to set her off. And apparently my father would joke that my first words were, of course, weren't my first words. My first phrase was, I just can't stand it anymore. Apparently my mother would repeat that, I just can't stand it anymore. There was something about being a mother that she just, I don't know what it was. Well, what I know now from after I started therapy, you know, 5 years ago, and reading a lot about just early child development, is that those first 3 years, 0 to 3, are so the most important in terms of just forming attachments to the parents, feeling that you're in a nurtured and safe environment. And obviously, just from the screaming alone, I wasn't. I started developing panic attacks, having anxiety attacks. When I was about 3, I didn't know what they were. I just knew that it happened all the time. I knew the feeling. Just didn't know how to actually intellectualize what they were. It was my brother came along. Like I said, we were about a year and a half apart. My earliest memory, so my father would travel and he'd be home on the weekends, and it was always, oh, wait till your father gets home. There were no timeouts like there are now. There was only the black belt, so we would just black belt from my father on a bail bond. That was what I considered a normal punishment. These started also from my earliest memory. But my father was also somewhat, I would just say, dysregulated, and he would just fly into a rage. And his rage was not screaming. His rage was physical abuse. I can remember my brother and I may have been 4 and 5 years old around that time when, I don't know what we did, but he became so angry. He took us both by our hair, and he banged our heads together as hard as he could, twice. And I just remember being so confused and not knowing why. And I remember, oh, it hurt so much. And so I didn't know whether I should be mad at my dad, upset with myself for making him so mad, or mad at my brother. My brother's head was really hard, and it hit mine, and that really hurt. That was my earliest memory of the physical abuse. It was around, I was 11 or 12, when my father just, there were a couple times when he just flew into such a rage over something that I had done that, and I could always see it coming. I could see it coming in his eyes, where he would just, like I said, dysregulation. He just would not be able to control his anger. And I was years old, the first time that he just completely lost control. And the first time she hit me so hard that I flew over my head, on my head, and landed on my back. And my siblings and mother were home. My mother take to what the next, which was my father straddled me. I was on my back after landing on it, flying across the room and landing on it. It straddled me. He was pinning me down and was punching me as hard as he could. And at first, I remember trying to fight him off with my hands, just trying to fight him off physically. And of course, he was about 100 pounds heavier than I was, and that wasn't successful. And I remember when that wasn't successful, I did line of defense. I completely dissociated, or I believe it's called depersonalization, where I didn't feel anything after the first punch, and after I just couldn't fight him off. I remember just completely leaving my body, floating out of my body, and looking at the scene from above. And I couldn't feel anything. I could see it, and I could hear in the background like the screams of my brother and sister yelling for him to stop. And I remember thinking to myself, how is this going to end? I don't know how this is going to end. But I don't think it's going to end well, because I'm either going to be dead or it's going to stop when he finally runs out of steam. And when he finally ran out of steam and I lived, we're being taken to our bathroom. And I looked at myself in the mirror. I couldn't even recognize my face. I was unrecognizable, and I didn't feel a thing. And my siblings were released from the other bedroom. And I learned later that I was reporting to one of my siblings that after they were released from the bedroom and saw me, they were not allowed to nurture me. They were allowed to come near me, but my mother ended them that they better not tell anyone, because it would ruin our family, and they had to stay silent. All I remember was the appearances were very important in my family. Appearances were paramount. My mother's, I think she just thought, if it looks good, it is good. So the way I looked after the beating, I was so ugly. My face was completely unrecognizable. I was bruised. I was bloody. I had braces at the time, so my lips were broken open and bleeding from where my lips had hit my braces. And I remember thinking, and I wrote this in the journal, it's one of the other first entries I wrote, I made my father so mad. This is 100% my fault. And not only is it my fault that he beat me, but now I'm so ugly. And that's the worst thing you can be in my family, is ugly. And I remember writing, I don't even deserve to be alive. I just don't even deserve to be alive. I look like I'm not even worth being on this earth. So just to give you a little insight of what goes through, a kid's mind, that was definitely going through my mind. So that happened a couple times around that age. And I wrote about it, and Dr. and I discussed it, but it was, I was about 38 years old when I realized that from that beating, I had not only lost some hearing in my right ear, but canine had been knocked dead. It was just the tooth was deadened from the impact of the beating, or one of those beatings around that time, and so I had to get a root canal. And going to get a root canal, I didn't know it. The tooth was infected. I didn't feel a thing. I had never felt a thing on that tooth. I had no idea it was dead. Of course, I'd always had this gray tooth. I'd never even noticed it until I went to the dentist. And it had been gray since I was 11 or 12, because dead teeth look gray. And so the point is that I had a root canal at 38, and then at 46, 47, the root canal failed, and I needed to have the tooth crowned. So I wanted to have the tooth crowned, and I decided I was sick and tired of looking at a gray tooth, so I wanted to crown all the teeth around it so that it all was the same. I felt like I deserved that. I was sick and tired of looking at a gray tooth that reminded me of the event. And during that process, if you've ever had a tooth crowned, they numb it, right? And once it's numb, once the teeth are numb, they can go ahead and do what they need to do. Well, so I'm numbing, they're numbing all six teeth. One is dead, five are not. Imagine. I need no amount of Novocaine. The dentist went to the stronger one. He kept shaking his head. He kept saying, I don't understand what's going on. The only tooth that shouldn't need numbing is the one that's dead. The rest of them should be feeling something. Those would be painful if the numbing agent wasn't working. But the one that's dead is the one that's hurting him. He was shaking his head. But now I understand what's going on. I dissociated the pain. And it wasn't until I went and had that procedure, maybe because I decided that I wanted to fix it and I was acknowledging what had happened, but all of a sudden, all that pain that I should have felt when I was 11, I was feeling at 46, 47 years old. And I was, I mean, it was the most unbelievable pain, and I was flailing my arms and nothing. I mean, I had to go through the procedure in pain. There was nothing that could alleviate it. When I reported back to Dr. Weber in my next appointment about just what happened, he said, you know, you need to write it down. You need to write down what happened to your tooth. You've never talked to your family about it. You've never talked about the abuse. My father passed away a few months earlier, so he wasn't involved in the letter that I wrote. But Dr. Weber said, write a letter. Tell about the abuse when you were 11. Tell them about what happened to your tooth. Tell them about what you experienced today. Put it in writing. Send it off to your family, to your mother and your brother and sister. So I did. The point is this. I think part of also completely dissociating when you start going through therapy is bringing those events back to life. And so you're, when you dissociate, you're almost frozen. But when you're recovering those events and naming them and talking about them, you begin, I guess, unfreezing, right, becoming more aware, and your body becomes more aware. So I was able to not only feel the pain, but I was able to bring up more memories. So it was about after I wrote that letter about the tooth to my family, 2 weeks later, that I walked into Dr. Weber's office, and I told him something that I'd never been able to tell anyone. I hadn't been able to admit to myself. But when I was 7 or 8, 9 years old, I woke up as my father was molesting me. And I was so ashamed of the fact that it happened that I convinced myself that I dreamt it. How could I have a dream like that about my father? And I completely assumed all the blame for myself. And I carried that until I was 46, 47 years old. Now that I've been in the healing journey and I've become so aware of grooming, and this is an addition to my story from a year ago, is that what I realize is that, you know, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show today, sometimes when you grow up or things that you're exposed to, you just think are normal. Well, what I realized is when, you know, my brother and I were really young, before my sister came along, we were like 2 and 3 years old, we'd wake up every morning, we'd run to my parents' bedroom, you know, we'd jump to their bed, my brother would jump towards my mother, and I would jump towards my dad. My father would pull me up onto his stomach and lay me there, and I was in underwear, I wasn't in diapers. I was about 3, and he would just put his hands down my pants and just keep them there. Every day, it was every day that that my parents were home, my dad wasn't traveling, we'd run to the bedroom. My brother would run to my mother, I'd run to my father, put me on his stomach, he put his hands on my pants. Every time, for a year, maybe a lot longer than a year. And he'd just keep them there, and I just thought that was normal. My mother, laying in the bed next to him, just looked the other way, after day, month after month.
Goodness, I'm so sorry. I'm just listening to your story, right? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, this is grooming. So
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
What I realize now is that, you know, my mother's pattern was just to ignore. But it was happening right before her eyes, day after day, in the very same bed where she lay. And that, you know, her neglect of that current ability to address it. That was beyond abuse, because that was torture. Because every day that my dad did that, and every day she looked the other way, she opened up the opportunity for my father to do what he did and molest me. So she tormented me, because that was torture.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, Penelope. I really am.
Yeah, but I thought up until a year or so ago that was normal. And so I do think it's important for us to speak these things and to say these things, because grooming, mm-hmm. these things evolve. And sometimes we don't even recognize them as what they truly are. Because like I said,
Yeah, I think it's a good time to actually take a little break if y'all want to. Kim, if you're okay with it, can we break off and maybe go to the panel from here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and take it from here?
Yeah, well, I just want to say again, Penelope, as I was saying, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but my heart is breaking for you, and I'm so sorry that you had to go through all that. None of those single incidents should have ever happened. And, you know, all of them together is just incomprehensible that, you know, children have to go through that. I know that we hear about this all the time when we're on this show, but it still just makes me really mad. It makes me mad, and it makes me sad for you that you have to go through that. And I wish I could reach through this phone and give you a big hug.
Thank you. Thank you.
It comes from all
of
us.
The good news is, I'm the luckiest girl in the world, right? Because I've been able to address this, right, and bring it up and bring it out. And it's no longer inside me, right, which is just the best part of being on the show, right, like we are right now, and the support that we have from people that understand, you know, because our experiences might be slightly different, but we know what the feeling is like to carry this inside and just, you know, being able to have the platform to talk about it. It is so healing, because it's another part of, to me, it's another part of dissociation in terms of just being able to actually not keep it in, but actually let it out.
Because like we've talked about before, Penelope, is your body feels that, and you've said that too.
Yeah.
And your body knows, even if you're trying to hide it, there's, you know, different things that happen that just tell you, oh, something is not right.
The body doesn't lie. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great point, because I think if anybody's out there doubting their memory, well, memory is one way to recall events of one's life, but the body doesn't lie. So if you don't trust your memory, trust your body.
Yeah.
Because my body was
absolutely
carrying
and
all
I...
sorts of things. Yeah.
Oh, so much abuse. You know, and as you said, I keep thinking back to, we have no clue if that's the way we're being raised, that's wrong in any way. And I think that, you know, as children, a lot of times we'll go to school and we start to notice little changes in our classmates. And so we're like, wait a minute, you know, that's not how my parents react if I say something to them, or, you know, that's not what... If I accidentally got gum in a chair or something, my parents would, you know, just fly off the head. So you start having these conversations with other kids, and you're like, that doesn't sound the same as my house, you know? And then you start to realize that there's love, and I think that, you know, unfortunately what a lot of us missed is that loving part of, you know, all we got was the abuse. So so let's go on to the panel and answer some more questions here. I could just sit here and talk to you the whole time, but I know there's other people. And we need
so,
to
yeah, we'll
get the show going. So.
Yeah, no, let's bring on Shamika. So I muted her mic. Shamika.
Hi. Hi, Penelope. Hi, Kim, again. Thank you so much, my gosh, for sharing your story. You brought up two critical concepts or issues is familial this is something that did just not, it didn't just happen overnight. Child abuse usually has roots, and the roots are very, tend to be very long. And so that was one of the things, and I think that helps for us to try to make sense out of something that is nonsense. Try to make sense that, okay, this did not start with me. This is something that has been going on for a long time. And even when you brought up the story, the incident about your mother laying aside you, being there in the same room, I think, believe you said, in the same bed, in the same area. And so that even opens the door about her roots, you know what I'm saying? Not in judgment, but in about understanding how this happens, that you were not the first to experience pain. Because when we experience pain, a lot of times we act, some people act in pain, they act out of pain. So you weren't the first one to experience it. When we hurt others, typically we are hurting ourselves. When people hurt other people, they are hurting from something that happened to them. And so the other thing that you brought about is that our body knows. So no matter what we tell ourselves, and even when you said that you tried to, you thought it was like a some type of dream that happened to you, your body knew. And that's what I think every listener needs to hear, every person needs to hear that's been through abuse, is that no matter whatever you tell yourself, your body knows the truth. And it's through the truth that we tend to break this familial cycle. We tend to break this cycle of pain. So I commend you for wrapping that in your story. So I hope that people really get that this didn't, child abuse is part of a bigger issue when we talk about pain. And it's something that has roots to it. And the second, of course, again, was that is that your body knows what's going on. And eventually it has to come out, because that's the only way that we can start to change. We can break the cycle and not continue it on into other lineages, into generations. So thank you so much. I know you said this is like your third time sharing your story, but I hope whoever is listening really gets that out of your story, the truth, how the truth can really set you free. You did an excellent job in the beginning of telling the story. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. I love you.
And I do want to say that no child deserves to go through it. But now that we've been through it, what can we do to help ourselves heal and to help other people heal? And so I believe that's what this show is about, is that you've gone through it and no child deserves it, but how can we heal from this and break that cycle? So thank you so much, Penelope.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
Hello, Penelope.
Hello.
Oh, man. I don't know where to start. Why don't we go to Chris right now?
Okay.
I think that's me, right?
Yeah, you're unmuted.
Okay, super. So I'm curious, you know, when you're telling the story, you kind of bounce back and forth, at least me as a listener, between things you remember and things you say, maybe your body remembers, like the tooth thing, or things that you learned through the process of therapy. And would you say that your recovery started with that work incident and then that gave you an opportunity to dig deeper, or was it something you always knew and you just kind of needed someone to guide you? So I'm sure there are people who are thinking, you know, what's in my past, or how do I find out my own story?
Well, yeah, that your question is kind of difficult to answer, because I would just say that disregarding the molestation that I, you know, woke up, right, and then convinced myself it was a dream. So that dream would come back to me many times in my life, what I thought was a dream, but that incident, and I would push it back down. So it's something that I always had. It would come up every couple years, and I'd push it back down. I wouldn't even allow myself to think about it. And it wasn't even something that I would have even considered addressing. I mean, my mode of operation until I was, 46 years old was just to ignore it. I mean, that's the pattern that was established in our home. That was a pattern that I established in myself. So I don't know if that answers your question going back and forth. But,
I know you're on here trying to help other people. And so, like, your story kind of picks up when I think you said you were 41 or something like that, looking backward. What would you say to people who, like you, who might, talk to your 10-year-ago self? What advice would you have wanted or appreciated having? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think that just gave me permission to go talk to someone because you saw that I was being hurt in some way and that I was hurting. So I would just tell someone, if you're hurting, take a moment, right? Take a moment to check in with yourself. If you're hurting, if you experience anxiety, if you experience depression, if you have areas of your body that hurt that you don't know where, if you have bad dreams, I mean, these are all signs, right, that there are things that are suppressed. But I think that my healing journey began because someone saw me hurting, but in reality, I was literally exhausted. I was carrying all of those burdens. I was carrying all the child abuse, all this holding in all the secrets, all of the secrecy of all the abuse that I had experienced in my entire life. I was carrying that on top of a career that was, I was working 80 hours a week, on top of having a husband, running a household, having three sons all year apart. And they were, they were maybe 12, 13, 14 when I started going into therapy. I was literally on the verge of collapse. I was so exhausted. And I was, one adult manifestation of child abuse is hypervigilance and overfunctioning. And I was, those were patterns that I had, developed early on in life. And I was literally trying to overfunction and I was hypervigilant to the point of exhaustion. So I would just say to anybody listening, if, check in with yourself. If you're noticing some of these behaviors, if you feel like you are on the verge of collapsing, I got to that point. I would just pray that nobody else would get to that point. So those are all, I don't know if that answered your question, those are all signs.
Yeah, those are really good insights, and you really had an amazing journey. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know.
Okay. Great, Chris. Thank you so much for that. Penelope, I just want to tell you so much that, everybody on this panel and everybody that's listening around the world right now loves you to the end of the earth, okay? And in telling your story like you are, just touches us that much more, as being a family, the family that we have grown to know today, which is absolutely been beautiful to me, and I can tell it's been beautiful to you and everybody else that's listening, I believe, too, okay? When you hear someone who I work with and go to the depths of what you told us a little while ago, really puts us back into a situation where, all of us need to really focus on the truth, what is the actual truth, and Tamika and Kim, y'all are beautiful and y'all brought up great points. I mean, Tamika, come on, you got it. I mean, even, with myself, I'm basically handicapped almost, but I'm a great athlete. Thank God. That's all I got going, otherwise I got serious physical issues, and it's all due to what happened. And, with Kim, and she's bringing up a good point about, noticing some changes in some classmates, you know, and this is where a lot of this gets started, you know. And even the hearsay between students can say, oh, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're saying. Well, guess what? You know, they are saying it. We have to recognize, all right, that's where it starts. So let's not overlook that anymore. You know, we can't do that anymore because that's how it happens, you know. And unfortunately, it's overlooked way too much in the past, and that's a lot of the blame. Okay, all right, in my opinion, is the fact that people just weren't educated enough. They were not, educated on what are the signs of different ages at that. We all know that it happens at different ages, but when you are a teacher and you see changes, come on, you know, something's going on either at home or something's going on with that, okay? And it's going to be one or the other. I can promise you it's probably going to be, you know, and that's what we have to recognize these days, and we have to stand up and do something about, you know. And you are that prime example, and as probably all of us here tonight, especially on the panel, are, you know. We have to stand up and be that role model and that educator for everybody to let them know that, it's over, okay? It's not going to happen anymore. If it does happen, you will pay. We can promise you now that you're going to pay, all right? But no matter what anybody has to do, the laws are changing for the benefit of us, okay? When I say us, I mean anybody that is on this panel around the world living today and the unborn children, okay? I mean, think about it. You know, people in young families don't even know what's out here in the world waiting on them yet until they get involved with this. And then they're like, what? You know, what do I do? You know, it kills so much in a line of a family trying to grow and be prosper in the world when you have this type of interference, which has to end. But, you know, going back, and I'm going to end this real quick because, you know, I love you to death, and it just makes me mad to hear this. But, you know, we need to hear this. And I want you to know I love you so much. And anytime, I'm always here for you, no matter what. And the only one thing that you started out is when you said that when you went to your doctor and he wanted you to start a journal, okay? How important do you think that is? And now I've been through this, and I think a lot of us here have, but what about the people that haven't yet? Or what about letting them know about how to even start that? You know, because, hey, what do you do? What do you write down? You know, because it's so confusing, you know. So mm-hmm. What do you recommend as far as that goes? And what did that benefit too by you doing that? Okay.
So yeah, thank you, God, and thank you for all your comments. Let me too. Thank you. Just overwhelmed. So mm-hmm. I'm at a loss for words for once. You guys know me well. I'm never lost for words, but I am right now. So I know that journal writing isn't for everyone, and I've really never done it. I've never been a journal writer, but I would say. It's a great modality. It's a great modality just to start writing. Just start writing down something. It can be my cat is laying down next to me. Start writing. Just start writing because it taps into your subconscious. And then mm-hmm. things will start, you'll start putting things on the paper. So if you don't know where to start, just start somewhere. And as I mentioned in the earlier segment, I was taught if you want to go deeper into your consciousness, write with your non-dominant hand. Hmm. It's really hard.
That's interesting. But how does that concept come up?
Well, that's what Dr. Weber once said, you know. If you want to go deeper, write with your non-dominant hand. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. what I noticed was I'd still kind of start out like, what am I going to write? And all of a sudden, though, and more quickly, I would start putting things to paper that pretty much shocked me. So really dig into what I was thinking, how I was feeling about, even if I was writing about a situation from childhood, I was just, what I ended up putting on the paper surprised even me, because I was going deeper into, you know, my consciousness, kind of almost beyond the subconscious, right? You're tapping into just a deeper level of your consciousness. Mm-hmm. And also my writing would become bigger at times, which would really emphasize, and I was surprised. I'm like, whoa, why is it becoming really big, right? But it would, meaning it was just really important. So I would say, to answer to that, you know, if you can just bring yourself to put a pen to paper, you know, just start writing, right? Because I think it'll open up a lot of things. And then write with your non-dominant hand if you really want to go deep. But then just have a lot of time, because you'll need to kind of go on a little walk or do something with, might need to, you know, pull yourself together after that does come out.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But I just want to thank you for doing this tonight. And I'm going to leave it at that. And love you so much. And we'll see you soon.
You.
Okay.
Right. Love you too. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, John.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hey, Penelope. So, I think, well, what else I was going to ask you is, you talk about how you like to come on and do, you know, do your story every year. What has changed since the last time that you told your story? What's different about?
Yeah, thank
in
you.
The last
so,
year.
I thank you for asking me that question. I did want to mention, like, Tamika and John actually both brought something. You brought it up too. You know, when I was in. I was around 11, 12, and I really had some visible bruises coming to school. And I had the same, you know, homeroom teacher. And she, the second time I came, she looked at me and she asked me, she kind of was, you know, she looked at me critically, like, okay, you're bruised again on the face. How did that happen? And I looked at her and I just said, oh, my brother was, you know, playing patch in the football, and I just hit me in the face, right? And I remember she looked at me like she didn't really believe me. And then she decided to let it go. At the time, I thought, oh, okay, good. I escaped that one. But now I think, wow, had she intervened, my life would have been different, right? Life would have been different. It was around that age, too, that I developed. I had literally, I don't know if it was from all the trauma. It was months after some of those beatings. I don't know if it was from the stress. I actually had a tumor grow out of the side of my head. A tumor. It was about, oh gosh, it was pretty big. All of a sudden one day there's this big bubble like coming out of my head. And I went to my mother took me to the dermatologist and he said he thought it was a big cyst and they removed it. I remember they removed it. I'll never forget. It was really painful. I remember him calling my mother over and just concerned. And apparently it wasn't hematoma, it was a tumor, and they sent to a lab and had it biopsied, and thankfully it was benign. But here's the point. I remember my mother getting the phone call, and she, like, cried and almost collapsed. I didn't even know why, and then she told me it was a benign tumor. It was actually a tumor, and it was benign. At the time, I thought I was really angry because I thought I deserved to know, you know, that this was not a cyst. I felt a certain amount of betrayal. That's how I thought at the time. But I look back now thinking, this gets back to children in general. No one asked the question, how does this healthy 11, 12-year-old girl develop a tumor that grows out of her head all of a sudden? Nobody asked me questions, right? And I look back now, I think, gosh, that was certainly a sign of the amount of stress I was under from the trauma of the house, you know, the abuse in the household. Also, just talking about adults, I never have discussed this before, so this is something new to answer your question, Kim. But I remember hearing Darlene Clark, our sister Darlene's story about, you know, being, you know, starving as a child. Well, being thin and being beautiful, like Tamika said, my mother had her own trauma, and I think she felt like the way her children could, you know, live with less trauma was if they were thin and looked perfect. So that was her focus, and I was starving. I just starved all the time. We were not allowed to eat when we were hungry. We were not allowed to eat any sweets. She had food that was under lock and key. So I'd be hungry. I'd also want a bit of food for comfort because it comforted me in this abusive home. And so I would break into this. I would pick the lock, get into the freezer, get the food that was also, if it was sweets, she would make cookies and they would be literally locked in the freezer, and then she put them in a tin, and the tin would be wrapped layers of masking tape. So I would undo all the tape, take a cookie, redo the tape, cookie or two, you know, redo the tape, and she'd always go and inspect to see how many cookies were left, and she'd find that some were missing, and then the screaming would start again, right? And I would just be cowering in shame in my room, feeling like a loser because I ate the cookies and I wasn't supposed to, and now I was going to gain weight, and she wasn't going to love me, but was holding the food. So I remember now, and I don't know why the pediatrician didn't even, so, you know, doctors, background noise, my phone's ringing at home, but, you know, pediatricians should be reporting these things. I remember I must have been on my first diet when I was six or seven, because I remember in a one-year period, I went from 65 to 67 pounds, and I was proud of myself. Now, a child that's growing should not be dieting and only gain 2 pounds in 1 year. Later on in high school, because I felt like, well, and as I said, this pattern is, if I'm perfect, maybe I'll be safe in my home. I stopped eating almost completely, and I went to about 98 pounds, and I was anorexic. A lot of eating disorders are also, you know, indicative of a child that's hurting. So that, of course, everybody was coming to them telling them that I was too thin. Obviously, I was anorexic. So then they would force me to have weigh-ins, and if I didn't do the weigh-ins, I would be punished, right? So I was never taken to, you know, a facility where I got any help. I was just punished for my lack of my eating disorder. So these cycles of punishment went on and on and on and on. So I think those are other signs, right, to look for is, you know, changes in weight, right? Those types of things are also indicative. But what else has changed? I think what's changed really is that right before the show last year, literally hours before I came on the show and told my story last year, I was so tired of living in secrecy. I finally decided to call my mother and tell my mother that my father had molested me. And her reaction was, I'm so sorry, I never knew. How did this start? And so I said, remember when we would run into bed and I was 3 years old and Dad would put his two hands down my pants? And her first reaction was, I never knew why he did that. That really bothered me, right? So her first reaction was one of disgust. And I thought, oh, my gosh, like my mom is finally, like, acknowledging what happened. Well, it wasn't long after, and she had decided, she had agreed to do some, my sister's insistence, to do some joint sessions with Dr. Weber to talk about some of this family of origin issues. Unfortunately, I had two sessions set up. My brother did not participate. My sister bowed out the night before, so it was me and my mother. And my mother came on the session and just said, she picked up, she took a call back. She basically said, you know, I've been thinking about it, and I think it's all in her head. I don't believe her. I need evidence to believe her. That was in the first session. So Dr. Weber said, okay, second session, the two of us are on. I gave her so much evidence. To quote Dr. Weber, anyone listening, any jury member, if this had gone from a jury, would have convicted. There was overwhelming evidence. I gave her what she asked for. I gave her so much evidence, I ended up telling her things that Dr. Weber had not even ever heard. I gave it all. I told her the truth. I gave her what she asked for. This was in June or July of this year. And what happened in my family, and I'm going to mention this, and I think it's really important to mention because I've heard it in a lot of different stories and I've read about it a lot too. Well, when you decide to go out and speak the truth and break the cycle of abuse, you know, you may have all witnessed and the abuse at the time that it happened in your family of origin. So you were in it together, but you may not all be in the healing journey together. So my mother, after giving her what she asked for, after giving her abuse that she could not dispute, she went to my sister, manipulated my sister, told my sister lies, things I said about my sister. All of a sudden, my sister's not speaking to me. My sister blasts me in a text message. My sister's not speaking to me. And so my mother absolutely refuses to believe the truth, and my mother completely betrayed me. My mother has insisted that she will never believe me. So I have had to make a decision on what to do with that relationship. So I've become, in essence, estranged from my family because I refuse, and this is the thing, you know, I refuse to live in those patterns. And speaking up and speaking out and addressing it and saying it and doing the therapy and recognizing the patterns is all part of the work. I can't have the same kind of relationship with my mother because I can no longer live in the secrecy of the abuse. I can no longer live with my voice being invalidated. I can no longer live with my mother looking the other way and my mother saying the sky is purple when the sky is blue. I cannot be in the healing journey if I'm living in a pattern that's neglect and damaging. So, unfortunately, this has happened in my life within the last year. But it also, I just feel like I needed, it almost reinforced, I mean, the pain of being betrayed by one's mother, and I just need to say this. I can't even describe. It's not pain of the betrayal from when I was a little girl, although that pain is there. It's the pain of the betrayal of giving 100% of your truth. One of the people that should still have your back. And not getting that is, it's a death. It feels like a death. I have been in deep, deep, deep grief. To grieve the loss of one's mother and one's family when they're still living. So this happens. I was hopeful that I could start this dialogue and this journey, and that some members of my family may also do their work, do their own work, and join in. But at this point in time, that is not the case. And one great thing about NASA and about the shows is that I hosted a special guest night. I think it was maybe John that was my co-host, or Carol, and we had a NASA member, her name is Holly Kenley. She's an author, and she had just released a book about 6 months earlier called Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers. So what a gift it was to be able to meet her, and I read her book, and that really helped, right? Helped read. It was a book about, she's a clinical psychologist, so she took, it was like a study of 20 women or 10 women that had experienced betrayal by their mothers. And she was her own case study. And they answered a series of questions and told their stories. And it was very helpful for me to feel that I was not alone in that. So that's pretty much what's new since I came on the show. But, you know, it really helped me also. I guess one more thing I want to mention is, you know, abuse can be physical. It can be obviously sexual. And it can be verbal. I certainly had my share of that growing up. But it can also be emotional. And I think, triangulation for my mother to go and talk to my sister and poison my sister and to talk. You know, I've learned a lot about triangulation and how damaging that can be, right? How damaging it can be. And I've learned a lot from that, just from my own experience of having my own mother poison, you know, triangulate for my sister and spread lies about me. And so in one way it's been good, though, to break the pattern, to address it, because I've learned about, I've seen a huge pattern of my mother actually going and manipulating her children, right, amongst each other, and how damaging that has been for our own relationships with siblings. And this has been going on my whole life. I'm, 50 years old, and I just this summer noticed this pattern. And I can't change her pattern. I can only recognize it, not contribute, you know, not allow myself to be in that pattern. It taught me so much in that I have 3 sons, and I do not ever want, I mean, it is so important for me, for them, to know conflict resolution, to be able to have open dialogue with each other, to have direct address with each other, and not to have 2 against 1 or pit each other, you know, basically not to triangulate within each other. And so it was such a powerful lesson for me to learn, because I now want to teach them the damage of doing that, and how to, you know, have, I guess, these open relationships with each other, and to keep these relationships nurtured and healthy. So in that respect, it's been a good thing.
Oh, wow. You've given us so much great information, Penelope. Thank you so much for everything that you're sharing. And sharing your stories is just going to help so many people. So thank you so much for that. And so shall we take a little break then and go to the panel and see if there's any more questions?
Yeah,
panel
again. So.
Yeah.
Sure, so I'll bring Tanika back on.
Okay. Yeah, Penelope, thank you so much again for being here tonight and sharing your story. One of the things, it was mentioned earlier, I believe, by Chris, was asking, what did you learn from the abuse? And that was one of the things that I learned from abuse is, regarding my story. And I'm not going into that detail, but one of the things that I did learn was that family members are human too. So often, and that was one of the things that prevented me from telling that I wrote about, was that I held these myths about family members, that because they are this person, they should do this. And that was part of the reason why I kept my abuse secret for so many years, is that we have expectations. And we're not to blame of having those expectations. But what I realized is that family have jealousies. They have anger, they have pain, and unfortunately, many don't know how to heal themselves in a healthy way. That means not projecting their pain onto others. And pain could be seeing it and not accepting or acknowledging it. That they could see it, but they're saying, no, because if I accept your pain, then I have to accept my own pain. And so That's one of the things in understanding, not about, because we can really internalize that and say, what is wrong with me? Why won't you accept me? Why won't you do this? Why won't you accept my truth? My grandmother denied my truth. One of the persons that abused me denied the truth of the experience. But like you said, the body knows. The body knows, and there are memories that go along with it. So thank you so much for bringing that up. Is that, you know, unfortunately, even family members, it can seem like they portrayed us, but in actuality, what I saw it as is they portrayed themselves first. I wasn't their first victim to abuse. They were their own victim first. Because once you cross those boundaries, once you cross those, you have just hurt yourself. And so that took a lot of pressure from me in realizing I wasn't at fault. And because you won't accept my pain, God allowed me to see that there was pain under their pain. And if they can't accept their own pain, then how are they going to accept mine? How are they going to accept my truth? So thank you. And I just wanted to share that with you, that I do understand the sense of betrayal, but I just refuse. I think we have to see, like you said, writing helps us to see deep within and look at the experience in such a way that is shifting the blame off of us and putting more of an understanding that we are not at fault. There's something else that occurred too as well. Way before we were abused. Yeah.
So also said something I thought was also very, poignant, and that is that whatever patterns or whatever, pain that, my parents had growing up that they didn't address, they avoided. Number one, I think children shouldn't have to carry their pain on the parents' pain on their backs, right? We shouldn't have to parent our parents. That's also abuse, right? That is, child should never have to parent its parent in any way, shape, or form. And the second thing, though, is that I've come to learn as well that when you healing is, it takes some strength, it takes some grit, it takes being able to know you're going to go through some pain before you start feeling, the peace that comes on the other side. And you got to have the courage. I think it's very great to face that pain. I'm not saying that people that don't heal aren't courageous. I just think I find it. You have to be courageous to go through that. And I think when someone close to you starts to acknowledge truth and starts to make the decision to go and face the pain, I have felt that others feel pressured and they become that, they're not ready in their own time frame. So you can encourage, you can show by example, but you can't force, right? And I understand with my own mother that she just, for whatever reason, she can't go there. I wish she could, because I saw my own father die. He held all this pain in, and it became so toxic. He died after 2 weeks of a cancer diagnosis. He had pancreatic. He died after 2 weeks. He was in so much pain. I always thought it was physical pain. It was so much both physical and emotional pain. I was so happy to get that death sentence. And so I totally get the pain that our parents can carry, with them through what they're holding inside, and having that compassion. But at the same time, if we want to break the cycle, I can't carry anybody else's pain anymore. I just can't. It's not something I can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's how we break the cycle. And sometimes we have to stand alone or in very little company when we admit the truth, when we tell the truth. And that's something that, we have to accept. That's part of acceptance through the cycle, is realizing not everybody's going to be on your side, including your family. And that's part of the healing process of realizing that. And, so just thank you for sharing that, bringing up a very good point in relation to the healing journey. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Tamika. John?
Yes, you want to go to Chris next?
Sure.
Okay.
Chris?
Okay, thanks. So, it's just amazing listening to you talk because you're so measured and calm and reflective, and it's nice to hear that you're intellectualizing this and processing it, and I'm not saying it in a detached way, but not in an overly emotional way. I think that's really amazing. But I do have a question. When they asked the question earlier about sort of your update, and you talked about your mother and kind of coming to terms with her, I mean, not so much the exact, incident that led to that decision, but, the internal dialogue, you know, that said, okay, I'm at this point now where I'm going to take a stand here, even though that has not been my historical pattern. Could you talk more about how you came to that decision?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So one of the first things I was assigned as well when I went to therapy, you know, 5 years ago with Dr. Weber was, okay, and maybe this is, as an aside, maybe this is a standard, like, therapeutic exercise. I don't know. But he said, well, I'd like you to write, after we discussed the child abuse for the first time, he said, you know, I want you to write each of your parents a letter. Write one to your dad, write one to your mom. And the letter should be, just let them know, you know, you just wanted to write them a letter with the truth, you know, maybe they, hopefully they'll appreciate a truthful dialogue from their daughter. And then in a paragraph, write your childhood, all the things that you want to take with you, you know, in your parenting model, you know, the things that you want to emulate. That's one paragraph. And then another paragraph, maybe, you know, write about things that you want to give back, right, the abuse. So think about it as two suitcases, one you're going to take with you, one you're going to give back. Write this in a letter. Then after you write, you know, what you're going to take with you, what you're going to give back, then write about what you've learned, and then, you know, write that you're going to be okay, and then sign off. So I'm like, okay. So I first started a letter to my father, and thankfully I did that one first. I don't know why I chose that one first. I think I started with my mother, then I just couldn't get it out, and I wrote to my father. I think I had done about 15 years with Weber on that letter, and then my father did get cancer and died 2 weeks later, so I'm glad I had that letter. I wrote it to him hours before he died, and I'm very, very glad that I did that. What I realized from that, reading my father that letter, is that in a way, and kind of we talked about this a little with Tamika, but aim and put something in writing and name the truth of these things, the good things and the bad things, so it was balanced. I had never discussed the abuse with my father. It was the first time ever that I had talked to him. I hadn't remembered that he molested me before he died. Well, I'd not remembered. I hadn't brought up in therapy. So that was not in the letter, but everything else was. And I'm so thankful now that I was able to read in that letter, because what I realized was those burdens that I was carrying, the abuse, those didn't belong to me. They belonged to him. And in order to break that pattern of me carrying the secrecy, but carrying his abuse, was to give it back to him. So with my mother, it was after the second session with Dr. Weber with my mother when, you know, she triangulated my sister, and my sister ended up sending me nasty text messages, that I'd read the book from Holly Kenley on Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers. That day, I went and sat, and I wrote that the first time. It took me 5 years to write that letter. I literally, John, you might appreciate this, I was in the car. I decided I was ready. I got home. I wouldn't even let myself go in the house because I knew that my mind, I'd get distracted. I'd be busy with chores. So I found some paper in my car. I found a pen. I went to an outdoor table in our home. I wouldn't even let myself go inside. I wrote with my left hand, my non-dominant hand, this letter to my mother. The two suitcases, the things I took with me, the things that I gave back. And I finally sent it to my mother. It took me 5 years. And what I realized is, how did I make the decision, or how did I change the pattern? When I sent her that letter, when I wrote it out, I was shaking. When I sent it to her, it was literally a visceral sense. I was going to pass out. I was so frightened. I don't know why. It was a truthful letter. It was a loving letter. It was truthful. It wasn't mean. It was, I told her I forgave her in the letter. I said trust was a different thing. I wasn't mean. It was a loving, honest, truthful letter. And I was shaking in my boots when I sent her that letter. About 2 hours afterwards, I was still shaking. And then all of a sudden, I realized to do that, because I'd been carrying all those burdens of her neglect and all of her pain. I'd been carrying it all my entire life. I'm 50 years old. And for the first time, I finally gave back what was not mine to carry. And honestly, even though I've grieved the loss of the relationship for now with my mother because she's not speaking to me either. She's not speaking to me. For the first time in my life, I feel free. For the first time in my life, I feel free and giving back those burdens that were no longer mine to carry. And it's not an unloving thing. She needs to, those are hers. Those were hers. They're not mine. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think it's really important to, you know, think that everybody probably is on a different journey and a different timeline, and they, you know, have different inputs that are affecting them and moving them along, you know. And, I mean, taking 5 years to write a letter is a pretty amazing thing. I'm sure you thought about it a lot.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, absolutely. And I did. And, you know, I guess I could have made the letter longer because there was a lot of stuff to put in there, but I didn't, right? And I know that as an aside, thing that happened, and it's somewhat related to my mother and the neglect, is that when I was beaten so severely on several occasions that I was thrown across, you know, a room several times, landed on my spine several times, that's acute trauma to the spine. And because of the neglect, I was never taken to the hospital. I should have been taken to the hospital. I had so many concussions, I had more than I can name. I had trauma, acute trauma to my spine. And now I've had 3 spine surgeries from that, and I'm going to have more. So this is the reason that we need to bring the awareness to child abuse, because had I been, had those injuries been tended to appropriately by medical professionals, I may not need more spine. I may not have had any spine surgeries, but I'll be having them for the rest of my life. So that is my life. It is my spine. It's going to be, you know, it is what it is. But hopefully by what we do, the work we do at NASPA, all of us being here and voicing the truth and bringing it out, hopefully we can bring awareness to this, and there will be other children that we can intervene with. You know, we can intervene earlier, or people can start healing earlier so they have permission to speak. This is what it's all about. So,
I mean, yeah, obviously times have changed in, you know, 40 years or however long it's been since all this started, you know, because I assume that just, I mean, you know, doctors and teachers and everybody, you know, is differently aware now.
I certainly hope so. I think that it's getting better. I think we have a long ways to go, though. I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. So it looks like we just have a few minutes left. Penelope.
Yes.
Thank you, Chris.
I don't know if John. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if John had anything to just add.
John, did you want to say something else? I'm sorry.
Just real quick, yes, I mean, this could go on forever with this conversation, because I'm a living testimony to that myself. Many surgeries on the back, got many more coming, and everybody here knows that definitely abuse has everything to do with long-term effects and physical damage, no question. And it's a shame that we have to go through this, but what I am going to say is that I'm finding different ways now to cope with each level of that pain, okay, because I got so much of it, is that I'm learning how to deal with it in different ways. So my only recommendation is that I've been going through this most of my life, is you're going to have to find the best way you can for your own body, okay, because a lot of it has to do with mood, all right? A lot of it has to do with being depressed and weather. You know, there's so many factors that come in to elevating pain levels and blood pressure and everything that causes that, you know. So you're going to have to find your own way, and that's all I could say with that. Otherwise, I just wanted to tell you that I'm going to be right next to you every step of the way, Penelope, no matter what, okay?
Thank you, John. Thank you. I know you guys can relate physically and psychologically. with the
unfortunately,
time.
Unfortunately, we all know.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us, just real quick in the last few minutes that we have left here, what is coming up for you? What is in the horizon for you? And how,
you've already
pretty much gone over how your healing process is going.
Yeah. Well, I on a day-to-day basis, it's just, I've learned to take one day at a time in terms of the healing journey, and that, it's just one step in front of the other, and that recovery is for life. We don't go through, we don't decide to speak our truth and start the healing journey and expect that we'll be healed one day. At least that's my philosophy. It is definitely something that is for me day to day, and I'm very grateful for it. I'm very grateful for it. The activism work that I do and will continue to do is part of the healing journey, because one of the, I think I would never wish for maltreatment for any child, but trauma on any person. I mean, life is life. We're not live in heaven. Life can be hard. But one of the things that I think has become maybe the silver lining for me is that I do have a deep empathy I've developed. I'm a very empathetic person, and I'm very attuned if someone experiences pain. And my profession now is I just have modalities that I teach. I'm a teacher at a local college where, I help with self-regulation and career exploration and some movement classes, but some academic classes. But I'm able to teach the tools of self-regulation and all the things that I wish I had growing up that I didn't have. So that's, I'm in my third career. I started my third career 4 years ago now, and I feel like my life experience and my empathy, I'm attuned to especially the students that are hurting. I think sometimes we have that sense of neuroception of youth, adults to child abuse, where we can sense these things. And so that's helped me to help other students. It's helped me to also become the kind of mother that I am. I always want to have my children's back. I never want to feel like you're alone when you're growing up in an abusive home. That is the loneliest, most painful feeling. So it's shaped the kind of mother that I am. And I think that's been a good thing. Right off the bat, I never want to repeat those patterns. And I think, obviously, nobody's a perfect parent. I definitely have not been a perfect parent. But one thing, and going forward, is even though my kids, I've got a senior in high school now, which is my youngest, and I have two in college, I realize that, you're a parent forever, and that, the healing journey has also taught me humility, to be willing to be introspective, to look at patterns, and to try and learn and grow and address them and learn how to navigate through this life in a way where I live in, I live where in the mindset that I don't have to be perfect, and I can always be growing, and I can always be getting better. And that's helped me to address patterns that I still have that I don't even, that I'm not aware of. So I think as I learn more and do more work, I can become a better mother, a better sister, a better daughter, and I'll continue on that. So that's in my future, and I think that's one of the big, the beautiful part of the healing journey. I wouldn't say, I'm thankful for my abuse, but I am thankful for the fact that I've been able to address it and heal from it. And actually, finally, I've written one publication. It's actually on the NASCA website. I've written an article because I really did find a lot of healing. It was my escape as a young kid around 12 years old. I'd go on walks in nature. So I've written an article about actually how outdoor exercise can help energize and awaken our minds, lift our spirits, enhance our cognitive performance, and alleviate depression. So I found that modality really helpful. So I have one thing that I've written, but I'm actually writing my book. And so that's in my future, and I hope to have that published. If not by the end of the year, then in 2022, the first half of 2022. And I wish I could do more with NASCA. I've got a board position, but it's a relatively small one. I'd like to do more, but I still have a child at home, so I'm just enjoying every day with him, still having a child in our household before he goes off to college. And then hopefully I'll be able to get more involved in all different kinds of activism work, not only within NASCA, but within other organizations to just help continue the mission, which is, you know, child abuse intervention, prevention, recovery. So that's it.
So you are amazing and very inspiring, Penelope. So thank you. I'm sure from a lot of people will be saying that about you tonight. But thank you again for coming on and telling your story and just being so open and honest about your experiences. I guess that does helps us all eventually. Some of us aren't quite ready for that, but some of us are really ready for it. So,
well, I just want to thank you, Kim and John and Tamika, and I know Chris did drop, but just thank you so much for coming on, hearing my story. I think I was a little triggered when I wasn't as fluid as I normally am, but that's okay. It is what it is. I'm not going to be, it doesn't have to be perfect, right?
You did great.
Well, I just want to say that I think that this has been one of the most empathetic, true stories that I think we've been involved with in such a long time, you know, with a lot of different ways, you know. And that's the one word that we use a lot, and it's so true. And this is the prime example of that same word of empathy. I think of it every day, you know, because I don't have, you know, the sympathy for a lot of things in life, but I do have empathy for what the truth is, you know, and this is definitely one of those.
Thank you, John.
Yeah.
Well, if I could just thank you. No, thank you. I appreciate that. I really actually have a quote that I saw recently. It was actually, I think it was on the NASCA website. I'd like to end with, because Dean and I started really in the healing journey 5 years ago, and I think I mentioned my kids were 12 and 13 and 14. They saw mom change, right? They saw me go to, I mean, I was pretty open about the fact that I was doing the work, and, you know, with change comes disruption. So my book is really going to be centered around, you know, what I've learned through the healing journey and pretty much why I did it and what I've learned. And I just wanted to read the following quote. It says, this is by Dr. Gabor Mate. I love him. As a rule, whatever we don't deal with in our lives, we pass on to our children. Our unfinished emotional business becomes theirs. As a therapist said to me, children swim in their parents' unconscious like fish swim in the sea. So, you know, as hard as it's been, as bumpy as it's been, that's why I continue on, because there's no way that I'm passing it, as long as I'm alive, that I'm going to allow the damaging cycle of abuse to be passed on to my children. So that is very, very important to me. And you all have inspired me. And every time I hear you, your stories, your comments, I learn, and you have inspired me and helped me with that goal. And I just really wish to thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being on tonight. Yeah.
So with that being said, the show's over. So thank you all. Thank you to me. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, John. And as I always say, as we
thank
end
you.
The show, you know,
thank you.
If there are enough adult eyes in the world to keep every single one of our children safe, it is our moral responsibility. So as an adult, if you see something, say something, do something, take action. Thank you all. Love you all. And good night. Good night.
Thank you. Love
good
you.
Night, everybody.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You
Radio.